Good morning and welcome to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Last week, we introduced you to residents of Castle Peak Retirement Residence in Bracebridge, who together wrote and published an anthology of their stories as a fundraising initiative. The book, appropriately called At Your Age, and the fundraising have been enjoying huge success since the book's release last fall, with $6,000 already donated to various charities in Muskoka. When I went to meet a few of the storytellers and the three-person publishing team at the residence on February 8th, I was so taken with their enthusiasm and brilliant personalities, I split the interview into two parts so as not to lose a single voice. Last week, we heard from Eve Jones, Edith White, and Liam Dwyer, who shepherded the book from idea to fruition, and this week, I am pleased to share with you portions of my interviews with six of the storytellers. They were in order of their interviews today: Marie Brewer, Minnie Boys, who is, by the way, 103 years old, Sister Mary Cartwright, Fran Avison, Bill Appleton, and Anne Trussler. I will mention that my interview was on site, and as much as we tried to find a quiet place, that residence is hopping with activity, so I'll ask ahead of time for your forbearance as we try to get those soft voices heard above some background goings-on. From my interview on February 8th, here are six of the At Your Age storytellers. We're going to begin with Marie Brewer, who has written a story from the war. Even though I've heard these stories before, the immediacy, the vulnerability of the story is so powerful, but I'm going to let Marie talk a little bit about sharing this story and how it feels to know that now it's going to be out there. Marie, welcome to Storylines.
Yeah, thank you.
Marie, tell me about sharing this window into your experience as a child in the war in Holland.
Came just with a cup of coffee.
It came with a cup of coffee.
Yes. You don't talk about those things. And it just came out of the blue. I not always think about it either. It was just conversation. And it came to that point from long ago. A memory. And that was the first memory what came in my mind.
And tell us a little bit about the story. You talk about the privations of the war and how food was just scraps from someone's table. And your grandfather, your ailing grandfather, lived with you in the family home.
Well, I cannot start it because there is no end to it. I wouldn't know how to begin because I know... don't know when the end will be.
I understand.
And that's maybe that's the reason why people who went through the war don't talk about it. Because there is too much.
Yeah.
You have it deep inside and it doesn't come out anymore.
But it was so brave of you to write this down.
Well, to be honest, I didn't write it down.
I just told it.
And then I was asked later of that story could be used for the book.
And someone very skilled crafted.
Very, because the poor man did it four times for me.
That poor man is Liam,
yes,
who will be
that's
taught.
The one. And he came every time with a typed out story and told me, if there is something that is not right, you change it or scratch it out. And I was scratching it. So by the fifth time, I thought, no, that's enough.
And how do you feel now knowing that this story is in a book and so it's permanent?
That's great. I have compliments from my grandchildren who have said to me, it is so great to read that book and to see and hear and read what you did and what you went through, because they didn't know. Not my own children did know.
Yeah.
As because you bury it. You keep it inside. You don't talk about those things.
It's too painful.
Yes.
Talking about it, having the courage to talk about it, and to remind us what it is to be in war. In North America, we're very lucky.
Yes. everybody should know.
Yeah.
But because we don't talk about it just once a year, that's when people think about it. And that's when you hear the stories. Not all, but some stories. Otherwise, it goes deep inside you.
Yes. Well, Marie, I am so grateful that you brought that story to light from deep inside you, because it really has a place in my heart. And I know that when this book gets into the hands of a wider audience, many people will understand the war from the perspective of someone who was there. And it will shine a light into your experience. So I really thank you for that.
Thank you.
Minnie.
Yes.
I think our listeners need to hear that I'm sitting here with Minnie Boyce, who is how old, Minnie?
103.
And I want our listeners to know Minnie is looking as spry and with it as anybody 30 years.
I'm very fortunate.
It is really a pleasure to meet you, Minnie, after having read your story.
Thank you.
And your story is called Just an Ordinary Life. And you were the second oldest in the family.
I was. I was six.
Out of six. And you talk about, you weren't told what to do, you just knew what your chores were.
Oh yes, that's right.
So what sorts of things? Did you have to look after the younger children?
Yes, we had to look after that. Them, and we had certain chores around the house, cleaning chores, for instance, help with meals, that sort of thing.
When you were growing up,
yes,
was there more of an expectation for a girl to simply get married?
Oh, you worked in an office until you got married.
And then you didn't work after that?
Oh, no.
The expectation was you'd have enough education that you could get an office job.
Well, not everybody, but if you had any, if you wanted to get ahead, you got an office job.
Okay.
Or a job in a store.
If you had ambitions for a career,
yes,
a girl would be looking toward...
You were very limited in what you could do.
Okay. A store clerk?
Yes.
Or...
An office
job? Or a school teacher, maybe?
I can't think of anything else.
In 103 years, you've seen a lot of things happen and a lot of changes.
Yes, I have.
Does something jump out for you?
Well, I came along at a time when things were not changing that much. I didn't work after I was married, and I did my own work, which most women did, looked after my children. Very uninteresting, you might say. It was a way of living. You looked after your house, you looked after your children. You worked pretty hard, actually.
And you didn't have all the modern conveniences, I'm sure.
No, you didn't. We had a washing machine, and eventually we had a dryer. It did a lot of things by hand that they don't do by hand anymore. And you did everything in your house. You cleaned and baked and sewed.
All the things that we just take for granted we can go to the shop and buy, you had to actually make.
Oh, yes.
Looking back on that, do you have any reflections on whether it's easier or harder to have more
nowadays?
Choices? Yes.
Pretty hard to say. It wasn't an easy life at all. Physically, it was really hard. I don't think you had to know as much as you do now. Maybe I'm wrong about that. You had to know different things. It was more less of a change in a way of living. When you look back, you were living in a lot of ways the way your forebears lived.
Wow.
Not altogether, but in a lot of ways.
Well, people must ask you all the time how you stay so young at heart at 103. What makes you so lively?
Just good luck, I guess.
Good luck?
Good luck.
I thought you were going to say good looks.
Well, that doesn't hurt.
Minnie, it's really been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, I shouldn't have read that book, really. Other stories of what women did are so much more interesting.
That's because you lived it, Minnie, and from the perspective of me as a reader, not having lived that life, I found it very interesting and informative, and it gave me insight. And this is one of the things that the elders in our communities and the elders in our lives are not given enough credit, or perhaps don't take enough credit.
Yes.
For how important their ordinary lives are in order to teach us, the rest of us.
Yes, that's true. Of course, an ordinary life nowadays is a completely different life, yet it is still ordinary.
Yes, that's well said. Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Pleasure for me, too.
Sister Mary Cartwright, you are also a resident.
Yes.
At Castle Peaks, and you have contributed to At Your Age. It's a little bit special what you've contributed. You've contributed poetry.
Yes, well, I'm nearly blind, but I can't see the read. I got to write on it.
But you've been writing poetry for a long time?
Yes.
And do you recall, were you a child when you started writing poetry?
I think the first thing I had printed was in Saturday Night when I was 12. 13. We were read to a great deal, and we learned to read very young, and it was a way of, sometimes a way of praying, sometimes a way of meditating, sometimes, and we were encouraged to do it.
Yes.
And we all wrote to a degree.
So we're going to hear you read one of these poems, Sister Mary, and you're going to give us Fall in Muskoka.
Yahweh, you came in burning bush once long ago to give your name. Yourself. Now as I gaze, whole trees aflame, burning and not consumed. Far as the eye can see, glory on glory. My heart lifts up to you, glowing with praise, staggered with joy, barefoot with awe. Your hand is on me, you have made me yours. Keep me in love of you, strengthen through pain, bring us to light and love.
Thank you very much, Sister Mary. Much of that was from memory, I could tell.
Well.
you remember this poem.
I remember most.
You remember most
vaguely.
Of the poems. Do you remember over the years how many poems you've written?
I have three books of poems, and one of my mother's wartime diary, and her poems, and my brother Jeffrey's poems during the war.
So you come from a tradition of poets. Your mother wrote, your brother wrote, and you write.
Well, I think from a family of writers, a lot of our family were lawyers or doctors.
Uh-huh.
My father was the head surgeon at the McKenna Sign Group, and we were brought up there from starting hospital visiting about one, I think.
My goodness.
And,
I'm sorry, where was the place? Military hospital?
Christie Street in Toronto,
okay.
And that
yes.
The McKenna Sign Group.
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, we had our summer cottages. Considerably north of this, it's on the French River, and Daddy bought it. In those days, it was very lonely and isolated, but we loved it.
Well, it's been a pleasure reading your poetry, and I thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
You've just been listening to Marie, Minnie, and Sister Mary. We're going to take a quick break, and we will return with Bill, Fran, and Anne from our on-site interview at Castle Peak Retirement Residence in Bracebridge. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. This is Christine Cowley. This morning, I've been sharing with you part two of my visit to Castle Peak Retirement Residence in Bracebridge, where I spoke with a group of residents who wrote and published a beautiful book called At Your Age. We continue now with three of the storytellers.
We're here with Fran Avison, who was involved in an industry that we really don't hear about anymore, and it was women's hats. And Fran, your business was warehousing hats for women.
Yes.
The demand for hats was very high in those days, and tell us why.
Well, every woman wore a hat. I mean, from early 1900s, the big plume things, but even in wartime, going to the grocery store, a woman wore a hat.
Your outfit really wasn't complete without a hat.
Or gloves.
And gloves.
Yes, they did wear them, of course, to inside for teas and dining and occasions, but they were worn a lot.
In your story, I found it really interesting that you talk about a change that you could not have possibly seen coming.
Well, that's right. It was a period of time when women suddenly had enough to enjoy the new fashions, and hats were all part of that idea. And we thought it would go on forever. But along about 1964, 65, there was a change in hairdo, for one thing. It's called a beehive.
A beehive, yes, and I remember.
Huge. And also at the same time, it just happened that the Vatican decided that women did not have to wear hats to mass anymore.
They didn't need to cover their heads.
Yes.
Yes.
And women stopped wearing hats. So all of a sudden, the grooming industry was nothing. And I think back, it's not as different as perhaps newspapers today or any business that recently has noticed such a change in their production and people wanting it.
That's a really good comparison, that with digital media and online publications being the norm now, newspapers have had to struggle and magazines have gone under every day.
Exactly. I never thought of it until recently, but so many businesses have suffered the same way. A woman's pride was in having an outfit that coordinated, and all of a sudden, that was gone. So the only thing left were things called whimsies. Whimsies were just little veils with dots on them.
Oh, I remember those.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I used to buy hundreds of dozens of hats at a time, and a dozen hats would be about $33. For a dozen.
Now, it's interesting to compare the difference in markup and that sort of thing. You were a wholesaler.
Yes.
If you bought a dozen hats for $33, do you know what those hats would then retail for?
The retail had to be about twice as much because of depreciation and couldn't sell last year's hat.
Oh, yes.
We shipped coast to coast, and in those days you didn't have telephone access or... We hardly ever saw 98% of our customers. So they could not get to our market. We would send a couple of dozen, some more or less on consignment, on a standing order every 2 weeks or something like that, during seasons. And they could look at their assortment, decide what they wanted to keep within 48 hours. Return the rest. Most of them kept them because of freight charges and whatnot.
So how did you find your retailers?
The business had been established in 1903, and as they'd gone on through the years, we sent cards out and letters of introduction. And
so it was done by post,
mm-hmm,
yes.
Mostly.
Did you do much by phone in terms of getting new business?
No. Your phone calls were exorbitant in those days.
So it cost you money to make phone calls?
Oh, heavens, yes.
It wasn't like a monthly bill like we get today?
No way. Long-distance calls were unique. Oh. We had little, I think they were self-addressed, three cents postage paid cards that we would send out. You'd get a list of customers from Dun & Bradstreet or something like that.
Yes.
At any rate, they had a basis of customers that went on through the years. So it was an interesting and fun business, but I didn't realize until I sat down with Lynn to write that story,
yes,
how much it had affected factories and European workers who did wonderful work with their embroidery, beaded work, the tremendous amount of hard work that went into it. But when it went, they all went too. Time marches on, and the way it went, so it was good while it lasted.
Well, Fran, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you and to learn more about your story.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Fran.
You're welcome.
We're here now with Bill Appleton, who worked in law enforcement. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what era was that, Bill?
That'd be in the early 70s.
And whereabouts?
This was in the region of Peel. My background goes back to when I was a member of the parole board for the province of Ontario. I was a reeve at the big town of Streetsville and was a member of the county council and involved with the provincial government in submitting a report concerning the amalgamation of five police forces into one Peel Regional Police Force. And, of course, every police force had a chief of police. So it was a job to select one suitable individual to be the head of the police force. However, the provincial government, in their bill making Peel Regional an entity, they told us, there were five of us eventually, that we said it could be done, and they said, well, then you do it. So I became chairman of the Board of Commissioners of Police, and we put them all together. It was a success because it's still an entity, and I was on the board as chairman of the police board for 9 years. When Liam asked me to put something together, I ended up with my story of police brutality.
Which is quite a different perspective than what we would think of as police brutality today.
That's correct. And I thought that if I could just put a little bit of humor into this, even though it is a serious problem, put a little bit of humor into it, and which is what I put in my my little story. It's a very stressful job, both from the administrative standpoint and the individual officers. So I thought I'd better put a little bit of humor in this.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you for your story. I'm sure there was some difficulty in deciding which story to relate. Now I'm here with Ann Tressler, who is a skier, was a skier. You gave us a story in At Your Age called It Always Comes in Threes.
Yes.
About quite an exciting experience. Tell us a little bit about that story.
I married into a skiing family, and I was determined that I wasn't going to be left home to cook the Sunday dinner. So I enrolled in some classes.
Yes.
And I was traversing a hill one day, and someone came down at a great speed and ran into me and threw me up in the air, and I came down and I broke the talus bone in my foot. So I was in a full leg cast.
Oh.
I had four children. One was a baby. And I carried the baby up and down the stairs on my thumb.
And I was in better shape then than I've ever been.
And then there was another accident after that.
Yes. I was skiing at Jackson Hole.
Yes.
And we were skiing out of bounds with a guide. And it was a beautiful day. And I looked up. And I said, what a beautiful day. And because it was like corn snow, like ball bearings, I went down the hill, head over heels.
Oh.
And I fortunately saw a tree. I don't know, I was just lucky, and I wrapped myself around the tree.
To hang on so you wouldn't go all the way.
Because if I'd gone any further, I would have been dead.
Oh, dear.
So they couldn't get a helicopter in to get me out, so they had to rope me out.
And then there was a third time.
Yes, I was skiing in Europe, in Austria, and we were traversing a steep hill, and the person in front of me stopped. I had no choice other than to go down, and that caused an avalanche. And I went down in the avalanche. But again, being fortunate, I remember being told to keep his feet pulled up so they could see you. And they did find me.
With just the tip of the ski pole showing above the snow, they knew where to dig for you. Do you know how long you were under the snow?
No, I don't. I think I was a little unconscious.
It must have felt like an eternity.
It did. I thought it's been a good life.
But you lived to ski another day.
Oh, yes.
And you wouldn't trade that, is
no.
What your story basically tells us. Yeah, you enjoyed it.
I loved it. And I was married to a man who lived to ski.
These days, you're not skiing now. No. Are there ways that you find to fill that gap?
Yeah, no, I really haven't. I miss it. I dream of it.
Oh, you dream of skiing. And sometimes in those dreams, do you wake up thinking you've actually been skiing?
Yes.
Oh, I like that. Well, Anne, it's really been a pleasure to meet you and to enjoy your story.
It's been a pleasure meeting you.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up part two of my interview with the storytellers of Castle Peak Retirement Residence in Bracebridge, whose lovely book, at Your Age continues to raise funds for local charities. You can purchase copies of the book in person for $15 or $20 including mailing costs by going to or calling Castle Peak Retirement Residence at 705-646-0808 or by emailing Liam Dwyer at liamdwyer2@aol.com. That's liamdwyer2@aol.com. Once you read At Your Age, you'll want copies to share with your friends and family. It's that good. And it's doing good with 100% of the funds going to local charities in Muskoka. You've been listening to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Please join us on Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. for conversations with authors and book folks about books and the writing life. Thanks for joining us.